The claim of the Samkhya philosophy is that beginning with the intellect, down to a block of stone, all is the product of one substance, different only as finer to grosser states of existence. The finer is the cause, and the grosser is the effect. According to the Samkhya philosophy, beyond the whole of nature is the Purusha, the pure soul, which is not material at all. Purusha is not at all similar to anything else, either buddhi, or mind, or the tanmatras, or the gross materials. It is not akin to any one of these. It is entirely separate, entirely different in its nature. And from this they argue that the Purusha must be immortal, because it is not the result of combination. That which is not the result of combination cannot die. The Purushas, or souls, are infinite in number. Now we shall understand the aphorism that the states of the qualities are defined, undefined, indicated only, and signless. By the defined are meant the gross elements which we can sense. By the undefined are meant the very fine materials, the tanmatras, which cannot be sensed by ordinary men. If you practice yoga, however, says Patanjali, after a while your perceptions will become so fine that you will actually see the tanmatras. For instance, you have heard how every man has a certain light about him. Every living being emits a certain light, and this, he says, can be seen by the yogi. We do not all see it, but we all throw out these tanmatras, just as a flower continuously sends out fine particles which enable us to smell it. Every day of our lives we throw out a mass of good or evil, and everywhere we go the atmosphere is full of these materials. That is how there came to the human mind, unconsciously, the idea of building temples and churches. Why should man build churches in which to worship God? Why not worship him anywhere? Even if he did not know the reason, man found that the place where people worshipped God became full of good tanmatras. Every day, people go there, and the more they go, the holier they get, and the holier that place becomes. If any man who has not much sattva in him goes there, the place will influence him and arouse his sattva quality. Here, therefore, is the significance of all temples and holy places. But you must remember that their holiness depends on holy people congregating there. The difficulty with man is that he forgets the original meaning and puts the cart before the horse. It was men who made these places holy, and then the effect became the cause and made men holy. If the wicked only were to go there, it would become as bad as any other place. It is not the building, but the people that make a church, and that is what we always forget. That is why sages and holy persons who have much of this sattva quality can send it out and exert a tremendous influence day and night on their surroundings. A man may become so pure that his purity will become tangible. Whosoever comes in contact with him becomes pure. Next, the indicated only means the buddhi, the intellect. The indicated only is the first manifestation of nature. From it, all other manifestations proceed. The last is the signless. There seems to be a great difference between modern science and all religions at this point. Every religion has the idea that the universe comes out of intelligence. The theory of God, taking it in its psychological significance, apart from all ideas of personality, is that intelligence is first in the order of creation, and that out of intelligence comes what we call gross matter. Modern philosophers say that intelligence is the last to come. They say that unintelligent things slowly evolve into animals and from animals into men. They claim that instead of everything coming out of intelligence, intelligence itself is the last to come. Both the religious and the scientific statements, though seeming directly opposed to each other, are true. Take an infinite series, A, B, A, B, A, B, etc. The question is, which is first, A or B? If you take the series A, B, you will say that A is first. But if you take it as B, A, you will say that B is first. It depends upon the way we look at it. Intelligence undergoes modification and becomes the gross matter. This again merges into intelligence, and thus the process goes on. The Samkhyas and other religionists put intelligence first, and the series becomes intelligence, then matter. The scientific man puts his finger on matter and says matter, then intelligence. They both indicate the same chain. Indian philosophy, however, goes beyond both intelligence and matter and finds a Purusha, or self, which is beyond intelligence, of which intelligence is but the borrowed light. Verse 20. The seer is intelligence only, and though pure, sees through the coloring of the intellect. This is, again, Samkhya philosophy. We have seen from the same philosophy that from the lowest form up to intelligence, all is nature. Beyond nature are Purushas, or souls, which have no qualities. Then how does the soul appear to be happy or unhappy? By reflection. If a red flower is put near a piece of pure crystal, the crystal appears to be red. Similarly, the appearances of happiness or unhappiness of the soul are but reflections. The soul itself has no coloring. The soul is separate from nature. Nature is one thing, soul another, eternally separate. The Samkhyas say that intelligence is a compound, that it grows and wanes, that it changes, just as the body changes, and that its nature is nearly the same as that of the body. As a fingernail is to the body, so is body to intelligence. The nail is a part of the body, but it can be pared off hundreds of times, and the body will still last. Similarly, intelligence lasts eons, while this body can be pared off, thrown off. Yet, intelligence cannot be mortal, because it changes, growing and waning. Anything that changes cannot be immortal. Certainly, intelligence is manufactured, and that very fact shows us that there must be something beyond that. It cannot be free. Everything connected with matter is in nature, and therefore bound forever. Who is free? The free must certainly be beyond cause and effect. If you say that the idea of freedom is a delusion, I shall say that the idea of bondage is also a delusion. Two facts come into our consciousness and stand or fall with each other. These are our notions of bondage and freedom. If we want to go through a wall and our head bumps against that wall, we see we are limited by that wall. At the same time, we find a willpower and think we can direct our will everywhere. At every step, these contradictory ideas come to us. We have to believe that we are free, yet at every moment we find we are not free. If one idea is a delusion, the other is also a delusion. And if one is true, the other also is true, because both stand upon the same basis, consciousness. The yogi says, both are true, that we are bound so far as intelligence goes, that we are free so far as the soul is concerned. It is the real nature of man, the soul, the Purusha, which is beyond all law of causation. Its freedom is percolating through layers of matter in various forms, intelligence, mind, etc. It is its light which is shining through all. Intelligence has no light of its own. Each organ has a particular center in the brain. It is not that all the organs have one center. Each organ is separate. Why do all perceptions harmonize? Where do they get their unity? If it were in the brain, it would be necessary for all the organs, the eyes, the nose, the ears, etc., to have one center only, while we know for certain that there are different centers for each. But a man can see and hear at the same time, so a unity must be there at the back of intelligence. Intelligence is connected with the brain, but behind intelligence even stands the Purusha, the unit, where all different sensations and perceptions join and become one. The soul itself is the center where all the different perceptions converge and become unified. That soul is free, and it is its freedom that tells you every moment that you are free. But you mistake and mingle that freedom every moment with intelligence and mind. You try to attribute that freedom to the intelligence and immediately find that intelligence is not free. You attribute that freedom to the body and immediately nature tells you that you are again mistaken. That is why there is this mingled sense of freedom and bondage at the same time. The yogi analyzes both what is free and what is bound, and his ignorance vanishes. He finds that the Purusha is free, is the essence of that knowledge which, coming through the buddhi, becomes intelligence, and as such is bound. Verse 21. The nature of the experienced is for him, the Purusha. Nature has no light of its own. As long as the Purusha is present in it, it appears as light. But the light is borrowed, just as the moon's light is reflected. According to the yogis, all the manifestations of nature are caused by nature itself. But nature has no purpose in view, except to free the Purusha. Verse 22. Though destroyed for him whose goal has been gained, yet it is not destroyed, being common to others. The whole activity of nature is to make the soul know that it is entirely separate from nature. When the soul knows this, nature has no more attractions for it. But the whole of nature vanishes only for that man who has become free. There will always remain an infinite number of others for whom nature will go on working. Verse 23. Junction is the cause of the realization of the nature of both the powers, the experienced and its Lord. According to this aphorism, both the powers of soul and nature become manifest when they are in conjunction. Then all manifestations are thrown out. Ignorance is the cause of this conjunction. We see every day that the cause of our pain or pleasure is always our joining ourselves with the body. If I were perfectly certain that I am not this body, I should take no notice of heat and cold or anything of the kind. This body is a combination. It is only a fiction to say that I have one body, you another, and the sun another. The whole universe is one ocean of matter, and you are the name of a little particle, and I of another, and the sun of another. We know that this matter is continuously changing. What is forming the sun one day, the next day may form the matter of our bodies. Verse 24. Ignorance is its cause. Through ignorance, we have joined ourselves with a particular body and thus opened ourselves to misery. This idea of body is a simple superstition. It is superstition that makes us happy or unhappy. It is superstition caused by ignorance that makes us feel heat and cold, pain and pleasure. It is our business to rise above this superstition, and the yogi shows us how we can do this. It has been demonstrated that under certain mental conditions, a man may be burned, yet he will feel no pain. The difficulty is that this sudden upheaval of the mind comes like a whirlwind one minute and goes away the next. If, however, we gain it through yoga, we shall permanently attain to the separation of self from the body. Verse 25. There being absence of that ignorance, there is absence of junction, which is the thing to be avoided. That is the independence of the seer. According to yoga philosophy, it is through ignorance that the soul has been joined with nature. The aim is to get rid of nature's control over us. That is the goal of all religions. Each soul is potentially divine. The goal is to manifest this divinity within by controlling nature, external and internal. Do this either by work or worship, or psychic control, or philosophy, by one, or more, or all of these, and be free. This is the whole of religion. Doctrines, or dogmas, or rituals, or books, or temples, or forms, are but secondary details. The yogi tries to reach this goal through psychic control. Until we can free ourselves from nature, we are slaves. As she dictates, so we must go. The yogi claims that he who controls mind controls matter also. The internal nature is much higher than the external and much more difficult to grapple with, much more difficult to control. Therefore, he who has conquered the internal nature controls the whole universe. It becomes his servant. Raja Yoga propounds the methods of gaining this control. Forces higher than we know in physical nature will have to be subdued. This body is just the external crust of the mind. They are not two different things. They are just as the oyster and its shell. They are but two aspects of one thing. The internal substance of the oyster takes up matter from outside and manufactures the shell. In the same way, the internal fine forces, which are called mind, take up gross matter from outside, and from that manufacture this external shell, the body. If, then, we have control of the internal, it is very easy to have control of the external. Then again, these forces are not different. It is not that some forces are physical and some mental. The physical forces are but the gross manifestations of the fine forces, just as the physical world is but the gross manifestation of the fine world. Verse 26. The means of destruction of ignorance is unbroken practice of discrimination. This is the real goal of practice, discrimination between the real and the unreal, knowing that the Purusha is not nature, that it is neither matter nor mind, and that because it is not nature, it cannot possibly change. It is only nature that changes, combining and recombining, dissolving continually. When, through constant practice, we begin to discriminate, ignorance will vanish, and the Purusha will begin to shine in its real nature, omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent. Verse 27. His knowledge is of the sevenfold highest ground. When this knowledge comes, it will come, as it were, in seven grades, one after the other, and when one of these begins, we know that we are getting knowledge. The first to appear will be that we have known what is to be known. The mind will cease to be dissatisfied. While we are aware of thirsting after knowledge, we begin to seek here and there, wherever we think we can get some truth, and failing to find it, we become dissatisfied and seek in a fresh direction. All search is vain until we begin to perceive that knowledge is within ourselves, that no one can help us, that we must help ourselves. When we begin to practice the power of discrimination, the first sign that we are getting near truth will be that that dissatisfied state will vanish. We shall feel quite sure that we have found the truth and that it cannot be anything else but the truth. Then we may know that the sun is rising, that the morning is breaking for us, and taking courage, we must persevere until the goal is reached. The second grade will be the absence of all pains. It will be impossible for anything in the universe, external or internal, to give us pain. The third will be the attainment of full knowledge. Omniscience will be ours. The fourth will be the attainment of the end of all duty through discrimination. Next will come what is called freedom of the citta. We shall realize that all difficulties and struggles, all vacillations of the mind, have fallen down, just as a stone rolls from the mountaintop into the valley and never comes up again. The next will be that the citta itself will realize that it melts away into its causes whenever we so desire. Lastly, we shall find that we are established in ourself, that we have been alone throughout the universe. Neither body nor mind was ever related, much less joined, to us. They were working their own way, and we, through ignorance, joined ourselves to them. But we have been alone, omnipotent, omnipresent, ever blessed. Our own self was so pure and perfect that we required none else. We required none else to make us happy, for we are happiness itself. We shall find that this knowledge does not depend on anything else. Throughout the universe, there can be nothing that will not become effulgent before our knowledge. This will be the last state, and the yogi will become peaceful and calm, never to feel any more pain, never to be again deluded, never to be touched by misery. He will know he is ever blessed, ever perfect, almighty. Verse 28. By the practice of the different parts of yoga, the impurities being destroyed, knowledge becomes effulgent up to discrimination. Now comes the practical knowledge. What we have just been speaking about is much higher. It is a way above our heads, but it is the ideal. It is first necessary to obtain physical and mental control. Then the realization will become steady in that ideal. The ideal being known, what remains is to practice the method of reaching it. Verse 29. Yama, Niyama, Asana, Pranayama, Pratyahara, Dharana, Dhyana, and Samadhi are the eight limbs of yoga. Verse 30. Non-killing, truthfulness, non-stealing, continence, and non-receiving are called yama. A man who wants to be a perfect yogi must give up the sex idea. The soul has no sex. Why should it degrade itself with sex ideas? Later on, we shall understand better why these ideas must be given up. The mind of the man who receives gifts is acted on by the mind of the giver, so the receiver is likely to become degenerated. Receiving gifts is prone to destroy the independence of the mind and make us slavish. Therefore, receive no gifts. Verse 31. These, unbroken by time, place, purpose, and caste rules, are universal great vows. These practices, non-killing, truthfulness, non-stealing, chastity, and non-receiving, are to be practiced by every man, woman, and child, by every soul, irrespective of nation, country, or position. Verse 32. Internal and external purification, contentment, mortification, study, and worship of God are the niyamas. External purification is keeping the body pure. A dirty man will never be a yogi. There must be internal purification also. That is obtained by the virtues named in chapter 1, verse 33. Of course, internal purity is of greater value than external, but both are necessary, and external purity without internal is of no good. Verse 33. To obstruct thoughts which are inimical to yoga, contrary thoughts should be brought. That is the way to practice the virtues that have been stated. For instance, when a big wave of anger has come into the mind, how are we to control that? Just by raising an opposing wave. Think of love. Sometimes a mother is very angry with her husband, and while in that state, the baby comes in and she kisses the baby. The old wave dies out and a new wave arises, love for the child. That suppresses the other one. Love is opposite to anger. Similarly, when the idea of stealing comes, non-stealing should be thought of. When the idea of receiving gifts comes, replace it by a contrary thought. Verse 34. The obstructions to yoga are killing, falsehood, etc., whether committed, caused, or approved, either through avarice, or anger, or ignorance, whether slight, middling, or great, and they result in infinite ignorance and misery. This is the method of thinking the contrary. If I tell a lie, or cause another to tell one, or approve of another doing so, it is equally sinful. If it is a very mild lie, still, it is a lie. Every vicious thought will rebound. Every thought of hatred which you may have thought, in a cave even, is stored up, and will one day come back to you with tremendous power in the form of some misery here. If you project hatred and jealousy, they will rebound on you with compound interest. No power can avert them. When once you have put them in motion, you will have to bear them. Remembering this will prevent you from doing wicked things. Verse 35. Non-killing being established, in his presence, all enmities cease in others. If a man gets the ideal of non-injuring others, before him, even animals, which are by their nature ferocious, will become peaceful. The tiger and the lamb will play together before that yogi. When you have come to that state, then alone you will understand that you have become firmly established in non-injuring. Verse 36. by the establishment of truthfulness, the yogi gets the power of attaining for himself and others the fruits of work without the works. When this power of truth will be established with you, then even in dream you will never tell an untruth. You will be true in thought, word, and deed. Whatever you say will be truth. You may say to a man, "Be blessed," and that man will be blessed. If a man is diseased and you say to him, "Be thou cured," he will be cured immediately. Verse 37. By the establishment of non-stealing, all wealth comes to the yogi. The more you fly from nature, the more she follows you, and if you do not care for her at all, she becomes your slave. Verse 38. By the establishment of continence, energy is gained. The chaste brain has tremendous energy and gigantic willpower. Without chastity, there can be no spiritual strength. Continence gives wonderful control over mankind. The spiritual leaders of men have been very continent, and this is what gave them power. Therefore, the yogi must be continent. Verse 39. When he is fixed in non-receiving, he gets the memory of past life. When a man does not receive presents, he does not become beholden to others, but remains independent and free. His mind becomes pure. With every gift, he is likely to receive the evils of the giver. If he does not receive, the mind is purified, and the first power it gets is memory of past life. Then alone the yogi becomes perfectly fixed in his ideal. He sees that he has been coming and going many times, so he becomes determined that this time he will be free, that he will no more come and go and be the slave of nature. Verse 40. Internal and external cleanliness being established, arises disgust for one's own body and non-intercourse with others. When there is real purification of the body, external and internal, there arises neglect of the body, and the idea of keeping it nice vanishes. A face which others call most beautiful will appear to the yogi as merely animal if there is not intelligence behind it. What the world calls a very common face he regards as heavenly if the spirit shines behind it. This thirst after body is the great bane of human life. So the first sign of the establishment of purity is that you do not care to think you are a body. It is only when purity comes that we get rid of the body idea. Verse 41. There also arises purification of the sattva, cheerfulness of the mind, concentration, conquest of the organs, and fitness for the realization of the self. By the practice of cleanliness, the sattva material prevails, and the mind becomes concentrated and cheerful. The first sign that you are becoming religious is that you are becoming cheerful. When a man is gloomy, that may be dyspepsia, but it is not religion. A pleasurable feeling is the nature of the sattva. Everything is pleasurable to the sattvika man, and when this comes, know that you are progressing in yoga. All pain is caused by tamas, so you must get rid of that. Moroseness is one of the results of tamas. The strong, the well-knit, the young, the healthy, the daring alone are fit to be yogis. To the yogi, everything is bliss. Every human face that he sees brings cheerfulness to him. That is the sign of a virtuous man. Misery is caused by sin, and by no other cause. What business have you with clouded faces? It is terrible. If you have a clouded face, do not go out that day. Shut yourself up in your room. What right have you to carry this disease out into the world? When your mind has become controlled, you have control over the whole body. Instead of being a slave to this machine, the machine is your slave. Instead of this machine being able to drag the soul down, it becomes its greatest helpmate. Verse 42. From contentment comes superlative happiness. Verse 43. The result of mortification is bringing powers to the organs and the body by destroying the impurity. The results of mortification are seen immediately, sometimes by heightened powers of vision, hearing things at a distance, and so on. Verse 44. By the repetition of the mantra comes the realization of the intended deity. The higher the beings that you want to get, the harder is the practice. Verse 45. By sacrificing all to Ishvara comes samadhi. By resignation to the Lord, samadhi becomes perfect. Verse 46. Posture is that which is firm and pleasant. Now comes asana, or posture. Until you can get a firm seat, you cannot practice the breathing and other exercises. Firmness of seat means that you do not feel the body at all. In the ordinary way, you will find that as soon as you sit for a few minutes, all sorts of disturbances come into the body. But when you have got beyond the idea of a concrete body, you will lose all sense of the body. You will feel neither pleasure nor pain. And when you take your body up again, it will feel so rested. It is the only perfect rest that you can give to the body. When you have succeeded in conquering the body and keeping it firm, your practice will remain firm. But while you are disturbed by the body, your nerves become disturbed, and you cannot concentrate the mind. Verse 47. By lessening the natural tendency for restlessness and meditating on the unlimited, posture becomes firm and pleasant. We can make the seat firm by thinking of the infinite. We cannot think of the absolute infinite, but we can think of the infinite sky. Verse 48. Seat being conquered, the dualities do not obstruct. The dualities, good and bad, heat and cold, and all the pairs of opposites will not then disturb you. Verse 49. Controlling the motion of the exhalation and the inhalation follows after this. When posture has been conquered, then the motion of the prana is to be broken and controlled. Thus we come to pranayama, the controlling of the vital forces of the body. Prana is not breath, though it is usually so translated. It is the sum total of the cosmic energy. It is the energy that is in each body, and its most apparent manifestation is the motion of the lungs. This motion is caused by prana drawing in the breath, and it is what we seek to control in pranayama. We begin by controlling the breath as the easiest way of getting control of the prana. Verse 50. Its modifications are either external or internal, or motionless, regulated by place, time, and number, either long or short. The three sorts of motion of pranayama are: one by which we draw the breath in, another by which we throw it out, and the third action is when the breath is held in the lungs or stopped from entering the lungs. These again are varied by place and time. By place is meant that the prana is held to some particular part of the body. By time is meant how long the prana should be confined to a certain place. And so we are told how many seconds to keep one motion and how many seconds to keep another. The result of this pranayama is udghata, awakening the kundalini. Verse 51. The fourth is restraining the prana by reflecting on external or internal objects. This is the fourth sort of pranayama in which the kumbhaka, or retention of breath, is brought about by long practice attended with reflection, which is absent in the other three. Verse 52. From that, the covering to the light of the chitta is attenuated. The chitta has, by its own nature, all knowledge. It is made of sattva particles, but is covered by rajas and tamas particles, and by pranayama, this covering is removed. Verse 53. The mind becomes fit for dharana. After this covering has been removed, we are able to concentrate the mind. Verse 54. The drawing in of the organs is by their giving up their own objects and taking the form of the mind stuff. The organs are separate states of the mind stuff. I see a book. The form is not in the book. It is in the mind. Something is outside which calls that form up. The real form is in the chitta. The organs identify themselves with and take the forms of whatever comes to them. If you can restrain the mind stuff from taking these forms, the mind will remain calm. This is called pratyahara. Verse 55. Thence arises supreme control of the organs. When the yogi has succeeded in preventing the organs from taking the forms of external objects and in making them remain one with the mind stuff, then comes perfect control of the organs. When the organs are perfectly under control, every muscle and nerve will be under control, because the organs are the centers of all the sensations and of all actions. These organs are divided into organs of work and organs of sensation. When the organs are controlled, the yogi can control all feeling and doing. The whole of the body comes under his control. Then alone one begins to feel joy in being born. Then one can truthfully say, "Blessed am I that I was born." When that control of the organs is obtained, we feel how wonderful this body really is. Chapter 3. Powers. We have now come to the chapter in which the yoga powers are described. Verse 1. Dharana is holding the mind onto some particular object. Dharana, or concentration, is when the mind holds on to some object, either in the body or outside the body, and keeps itself in that state. Verse 2. An unbroken flow of knowledge in that object is dhyana. The mind tries to think of one object to hold itself to one particular spot, as the top of the head, the heart, etc., and if the mind succeeds in receiving the sensations only through that part of the body and through no other part, that would be dharana. And when the mind succeeds in keeping itself in that state for some time, it is called dhyana, or meditation. Verse 3. When that, giving up all forms, reflects only the meaning, It is samadhi. That comes when in meditation the form or the external part is given up. Suppose I were meditating on a book and that I have gradually succeeded in concentrating the mind on it and perceiving only the internal sensations, the meaning, unexpressed in any form, that state of dhyana is called samadhi. Verse 4. These three, when practiced in regard to one object, is samyama. When a man can direct his mind to any particular object and fix it there, and then keep it there for a long time, separating the object from the internal part, this is samyama. Or dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, one following the other and making one. The form of the thing has vanished, and only its meaning remains in the mind. Verse 5. By the conquest of that comes light of knowledge. When one has succeeded in making this samyama, all powers come under his control.